Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm. Welcome once again to the Yacht Racing Podcast for what is the 11th of our Vendée Globe specials. Welcome to my expert guest, Conrad Coleman. Hi Conrad.
G'day, nice to be here again. Fantastic racing out there.
It is fantastic racing. They say a week is a long time in politics, and it seems it's even more so in the Vendée Globe, isn't it? I'm not quite sure what to say about the racing that we've witnessed this week. I mean, last week, other than Pip Hare's rudder repair heroics, our chat was all about the top three teams, Yannick Bestaven, Charlie Dallin and Thomas Royon, and whether Dallin and Royon could reel Bestaven in after, you know, after he'd been in the lead for so long and by how much. And now, just a week later, everything's changed. Bestaven's down to sixth. Charlie Dallin's back in the lead, but he's got Louis Burton in second and Boris Herrmann in third. What the hell's been going on? Can you make some sense of this for us?
I can indeed. It's called the South Atlantic, which I feel is something that we've talked about quite a lot in the last couple of months. And it is just the wild west of sailing. It's a brutal, brutal place, particularly just to the east of the Argentinian and then Brazilian coast. It is known for these very fickle, very crazy conditions. And you know, we telegraphed it from a long way off that that Bestaven was going to be in trouble. He had a strong lead coming around Cape Horn, and then in the initial part of his way, crawling his way up. And then he ran into no wind. Everybody else had more wind, and they sailed around it, basically. But we'll talk about it in more detail.
Yeah, I mean, so let's get into it with Bestaven. Did he make a huge mistake, or was he just unlucky?
Well, it's a bit of a mix of both, really. I think it comes down to the fact that he kind of had his hand forced. And basically, the way that you approach the this segment of the race is that first you have to go north as fast as possible. And so you need to go up past the Falklands, and then north, 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 and basically you need to get through that tricky barrier area that that was his undoing, which is called the South Atlantic Convergence Zone, and it's this sort of semi-permanent area of fickle winds that sort of separates the St. Helena high pressure zone to the north and northeast to the depressions that come charging around in the South Atlantic and the Southern Ocean. And so you need to get north. You need to get through that transition zone. Then once you start getting into the influence of the St. Helena High, you need to get east. And the reason you want to get east is because that will improve your angle when it comes to reaching later. And then once you get into the trade winds and you're up close to Recife, where the boats are now, or then you just need to get north. You need to get north as fast as possible, and that's when the foilers and are really going to make hay in these reaching conditions. So what was tricky is that transition between getting north as fast as possible and getting east, because basically what happened is that his two chasers, Thomas Royon and Charlie Dana, is that they invested earlier in the idea of going east, particularly when they saw that he was blocked in a different strategy, and it paid off. Basically, that the wind didn't come from the north; it became more clear in the east, and they sailed around him. That's basically how simple it was.
So, some advantage at that point to being behind. I think we talked about this. It was going to be difficult for him to, because they could see pretty much what's happening with him, and they sail around him. But we've also seen a compression in the fleet in general, because how many boats do we have right now within 100 miles of each other?
With Yannick actually in sixth place is 97 miles currently behind Charlie Dallin. So the top bunch is incredibly tightly packed. And indeed, to a degree that, I'm sorry, we've said this a lot, but it's unprecedented in the history of the race. You know, if you go back towards the last edition of the race back in 2016, where the boats were, or the equivalent, was they were incredibly stretched out. You know, down by the Falklands, just after going around the Horn, Alex was 380 miles behind Armel. He then got stuck in the same kind of scenario that hurt Yannick so much. But then, even though Alex closed up during this time when Armel was stuck, up by Recife, where the 2020 fleet is now, he was still around 120, 150 miles behind. This time, we have seven boats in 150 miles. So it's a whole different ballgame, that's for sure.
So put yourself on board observing Yannick Bestaven right now. I haven't seen a lot of video that's come off the boat. I haven't heard a lot from him. That's not to say he hasn't sent it. I just haven't seen it. Is he broken by this? Because he led the race for so long and now he's down to sixth.
Well, he's certainly not going to be a happy chappy, that's for sure. I agree with you. You know, I haven't seen much or anything coming off the boat at this point. And, you know, I don't know whether he's having a sort of quiet word with himself or whether he's not willing to or he doesn't trust himself to share his real emotions after being run over by the rest of the fleet. But for sure, you know, he was almost tied with Charlie Dunant as being the most frequent leader during the course of this race. You know, having been polled in that position 130 or 140 times. And while he certainly didn't have a lock on the race, he had a good lead so far into it, then maybe he was starting to dream. I don't know. But, you know, he's an experienced sailor and those of us who have been around the block a few times, you know, we certainly don't get too carried away by thinking about things that haven't happened yet. And he still had, you know, 5,000 miles to sail. So anything could obviously happen. But I'm sure that he's not very happy about life at the moment too, particularly because I don't think, and I may yet eat my words again, it's happened before, but I don't think that he's in a particularly strong position at the moment. You know, that the boats in the east appear to have more stable breeze, more wind strength, and crucially, more favorable wind direction. You know, one of the trends during the course of this past week has been Yannick slowly eking his way over eastwards and back towards the other guys. That you know, on Monday he was separated from their track by 150 miles or so east-west, and now he's pretty much on their track right now. And so in the early part of this week he's been sailing higher and crucially slower in when they were sailing upwind, and that's what led him to be pushed out the back of the fleet, the back of the leading pack, is that he had less wind and was forced to sail in a less favorable angle for his boat, and so that's why he got run over.
And we're moving into a different mode of the race here, aren't we? Because land hasn't had a huge impact on us. We talked about rounding Cape Horn and that being the first land some of the sailors would have seen for a long, long time. Even since then, they've been reasonably well offshore. But now, as they close in on that corner of Brazil at Recife, the land is going to start having an effect, isn't it? And it does go very light there at night. You don't get the thermal breeze at night. So there's a bit of a balancing act, isn't there, between staying offshore and, you know, maybe choosing the line that you want to in regards to the land.
Yeah, that's right. Once you get up towards Recife, which is the most easternmost point of Brazil, after which point you sort of consider that you're re-released back into the open ocean, is that you want to be at least 60 miles offshore to avoid the effect of the land that you're talking about. But then equally, you don't want to go herring off into the middle of the Atlantic either. And so it is a really fine balancing act. You're exactly right. You know, here, the priority, as I said earlier, is just to be going as far north as far as you possibly can and as fast as you possibly can. And naturally, at the point around Recife, the wind essentially bifurcates. So you end up with part of the wind going towards the southerly direction, part of it ends up going in a northerly direction, and you end up with calms around that point, which I've sailed around a number of times. although they're unlikely to see Recife because the land is not particularly high at that point. So maybe I've been running some routing. Maybe they'll end up close to the islands of Fernando de Noronha. But otherwise, you know, just on the topic of land, maybe they'll see the Azores as they go through it. But you know, from Fernando to Les Abdelon, it's possible that again they won't see anything but sea.
Life on board right now for this leading group, from a temperature point of view, it seems like it's been pretty warm, which is, I guess, nice, provided it doesn't get too warm. And I did hear Boris complaining that it had been super warm yesterday on board. He probably had to take his Christmas sweater off, which will have been a shock for him. But in terms of the breeze and what I'm looking for here is the stability of the breeze. Are they constantly having to adjust the boat? Are they making sail changes, or are they in a mode where they can kind of set and get into a fast mode and just do little tweaks?
Yeah, it's very definitely about the little tweaks at this point. And from the videos and photos that I've seen on board the boat, they are pretty much full main or one reef and upwind on the J2 sail. And so pretty small, pretty easy to manage sail plan. They've got everything stacked on the starboard side of the boat to give the boat as much righting moment as possible. And then it's small changes in mainsheet traveler and jib lead positions, because it can be quite gusty there as they go into the warmer latitudes. Then you do have more squalls coming in, and there will certainly be a lot of rain cloud activity that obviously brings both gusty conditions and also calms in behind. But primarily, it's all about optimizing the boat's performance with the sail plan you have up at that time, you know, give or take a reef. So it's pretty easy sailing in terms of, you know, not doing massive sail changes all the time. But in the next 12 hours, they'll go onto their fractional reaching sail, the Fro, as the wind goes from, I think we saw the same video from Boris when he was talking that he's sailing at the moment, so it's sort of 70 true, and then the wind will go to 90, and so then you get into a bigger, more reaching optimized sail. But it's incredibly bouncy. And again, not with the big swells, but just with with the wind waves, and when the boats, particularly in the next couple of hours, when they can free up and start to accelerate, is they'll be doing 20 knots over 1.5-2 meter wind chop, and so incredibly taxing both for the sailor on board and also for the boat. And there's starting to be the concern about accumulated fatigue in all of the mechanical components of the boat. So the big question is, we've seen these boats already self-declare as the walking wounded, with their foil apparatus not working particularly well, or some rigging problems or some electronics problems. Is how close can they actually sail to their theoretical performance? And then how close to that will the skipper let the boat sail to that performance, whether they have confidence in their package still?
Yeah, and for the skippers themselves, you talk about the boats, you know, being fatigued. The skippers, usually by this stage in the race, as you've said, the fleet is spread out, and it's kind of a case of, I heard one skipper describe it as, you know, you just kind of wring the boat's neck to get it back to Les Abdelon and get yourself and it back in one piece. But here they find themselves in a full on 6-way match race. That's tough, just mentally, right?
It is, and it certainly comes to. It's been relatively easy in the sense that they've been on the same tack for several days now, and so you don't have these sort of big stressful moments of doing a jibe and counting the seconds almost. Feeling like somebody else is breathing down your neck, but certainly they're all going to be sitting in their cockpits and very finely adjusting all of the you know, all of the go-fast ropes, trimming very, very attentively, and certainly a lot closer than they would have been had they had 500 miles between all the boats, that's for sure. And then just the feeling of when the computer goes ding, which means that a new position report has arrived from the FTP site, and sort of jumping down below to measure your performance against the boat that you know is just over the horizon, then yeah, absolutely. They're going to be easing through what little reserves remain of their mental capacities, that's for sure.
And how often do they get those position reports?
They come in 6 times a day. It always bugged me because obviously coming from New Zealand and obviously being involved in a very different kind of time zone, I was and remain frustrated with the way that it's done because it's all based around the European time zone. And so you essentially get the night off from position reports if you're in the European time zone. Which is always a little bit stressful because you're sort of sitting there wait after the night blackout, waiting to see what's happened in 8 hours when you haven't had an update. And then during the European day, you get them relatively frequently. But of course, New Zealand, or the other side of the world, is that it means that during the day when normally you would want to be sitting there clicking refresh, watching what's going to happen with the boats, there's nothing going on. So personally, I'd like to see them spread out during the course of the 24-hour cycle. I think that would be a lot more equitable for people around the world, both fans and sailors. And it's nerve-wracking having that long stretch with no position reports. You don't know what's going to happen. But then equally, you can use that blackout for strategic maneuvers. If you want to jibe, then you're going to wait until the blackout comes, and then your competitors close by can't see what you're up to.
I guess it's the same for everybody, but I agree with you that evening that out would seem more appealing from a fan point of view. But for the poor old skippers, it's 6 times a day. It must be like getting your exam results emailed to you. You click the file to find out how you've done in the last few hours.
Yep, you're exactly right, and you are constantly waiting for the new one to come in. Maybe you're trying something new. Maybe you're doing a sail change and seeing how that's going to match up with what you see from the other guys. So yeah, it's like Christmas morning and your exam results 6 times a day. It's really stressful.
Now let's just take a look at the two skippers who right now, as we're recording this, are in second and third place. I just want to check something with you, Borat. Conrad, the Boris Herman that we're talking about and the Louis Burton that we're talking about, are they the same ones that were, in Boris's case, had his mainsail on the deck virtually in pieces as he went around Cape Horn so that he never even really noticed going around Cape Horn because he was so scared of not being able to make this repair work and potentially be out of the race? Is it him? And is it also Louis Burton who, in the Southern Ocean, stopped at an island and climbed his rig on several occasions? And we mentioned it on the podcast weeks ago. Are these the same two sailors that are now vying for the lead?
It's astonishing, isn't it? And that's what I love about this race, because it's not you and the shore team that has to keep the boat in the race. It's you as the sailor. And so that's what makes it so comprehensive, a challenge, is that you have to be such a complete sailor. You have to be able to build and rebuild any system on board that boat and keep the boat as functional as possible. So here we are more than 3/4 of the way through the race, and you're quite right. The people here currently on the podium are those that have overcome incredible technical challenges during the course of their race that very easily could have knocked them out of contention. And I'm, frankly, hats off to Louis Burton for this incredible effort, keeping his boat in the race, and then time and time and time again fighting his way back into contention. I'm very, very impressed. Very impressed. He's done a great job, and for all of the fundamental aspects of the boat, in terms of the sails, in terms of his foils, and crucially his autopilot system, he appears to be on song, And you know, we've seen various reports, various photos from Charlie, and I think that he's had more of a thrashing from the Southern Ocean than he's been able to let on. And so I think we may be seeing Louis here being able to sail at a higher percentage of his boat's theoretical performance than Charlie. Maybe he may be limping more than he's let on. So even though it's a newer boat and on day one it was faster, it's going to be really interesting to see who's faster now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's easy to be kind of a little skeptical when they hide stuff from us, but I guess when you get to this stage in the race, that sort of knowledge being public is competitive advantage for sure. And Boris is looking pretty strong too. I mean, he made that mainsail repair, but in touching wood here, as I say, not to jinx him, as far as we know, his foils are in good shape, his boat is in good shape, and he seems as chilled as he ever is on board the boat. And he's a national celebrity now in Germany. Apparently, he's on the national news every other night.
A position that's well-deserved. He's a friend of mine, and I had the good fortune of being able to participate in the Vendée Live on Monday and being able to have a quick chat with him. And he's in good shape. He is struggling a little bit with the heat and with the boat banging over the waves repeatedly. But I favor him very strongly. It looks like he has made it through the south with his boat in really good condition. And that speaks to the fact that he's a pretty conservative sailor, as he says himself. He's pretty stressed. But he's kept the boat in good shape, and now is where it's he can maybe turn the wick up on his boat, given that he's in good shape. I'm excited to see what they can do. I think it's cool because we've got two 2020 boats that are limping potentially, and then two 2016 boats with foils in the top four who appear to be in a better shape. And so I think inevitably, we're going to see the straight daggerboard boats like Groupe Bissil and Damien Seguin. And finally, I think we're going to start to see Benjamin Dutroux start to fall a little bit by the wayside in these strong reaching conditions that's going to be coming up in the next couple of days. So it's the selection of, you know, the world coming to rights, quote unquote, of the foilers making a last charge towards the finish.
Let's talk about what happens next, Conrad. We've got ahead of us the Pot Noir. We've got the equator, the Pot Noir, the doldrums, as we like to call it. There's a lot of golf left in this hole, to use a really corny phrase, but there's a lot of sailing left in this part of the race, isn't there?
Yep, there certainly is. From what I can see here, they will be going through the doldrums on Sunday. It doesn't look to be particularly active at this point. It just comes down to a drag race. Obviously, not particularly active still means that there could be some good holes in the doldrums, and it's only really when you get the wind switching from the southeasterly to the north easterly position that you know that you're in the clear, because then you've made that transition from the southerly trade winds to the northerly trade winds, and once you're there, then it is just a drag race basically. You need to climb your way back up past the Cape Verdes, and then once you really get in halfway between the latitude of the Cape Verdes to the Canaries, is then you're setting yourself up to hook into a last depression that's going to whip you through the Azores around Cape Finisterre and then back into the Bay of Biscay and home. And so those are the essential breakdowns of what's to come. And by the time that we talk next week, then it'll be pretty clear as to who's looking strong and who got hung up in the doldrums, and crucially, who's able to put their foot down when they're in the strong reaching conditions.
Yeah, another exciting week ahead of us. Just before we close this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast down, a word, please, about Gitana, Frank Camas and Charles Caudrelier's huge, gigantic Ultim Trimaran, which set off 5 or 6 days ago.
So yeah, that's right. They essentially overlapped because Gitana left, and then within 24 hours, Sordevo came back in after their delivery from their aborted attempt. So some
little tag, painful little tag team,
painful symmetry there, I guess, for the Sordevo team. To watch their competitors heading off on another crack when they've just made it home, but they're ahead of the record at the moment, and even though the fact that they have a much faster boat than the boat that holds the record now that established the record in 2016, it just shows that an older boat with absolutely ideal weather window. Could still put in a relevant reference time for these new foiling boats. They're off to a great start. I would highly encourage those of you that are listening to this who are interested in the Vendée Globe to go and follow the Jules Verne trophy. You know, in many ways, it was the Jules Verne trophy that got me into this whole mix, because back in the mid-90s when Sir Peter Blake was chasing the Jules Verne trophy and trying to stick it to the French, that's when I got excited about going around the world nonstop on big fast boats that we shouldn't really have the right to be doing. So it's a really, really cool event. It's even faster, even more pure, almost than the Vendée Globe, because here you've got a rule book that is completely open. The boats are absolutely phenomenal. They are literally flying over the tops of the waves. And then what's great is that they have a really high quality media man on board, and pretty good stories and great images coming back as well. So go follow that. It's going to be a cool ride.
Any chance that the Vendée boats will see Gitana and vice versa, or no?
Yeah, it's possible. I haven't run a routine on Gitana, so I don't know how that's going to shape out. But certainly as the Vendée boats go up past Recife and start heading a little bit further eastwards as they line up into the doldrums, then it's possible that their routes could get very close. That's for sure. That would be funny because they're all from the same port and they're all from here from Lorient. It'd be fun to have them overlap.
It's just so great, and how lucky we are to be commentating on a sport where the racetrack is the whole of the world. It's just great, and one of the reasons I love it, and I know you do too.
So it makes you dream a little bit as the world goes from various cycles of lockdown to restrictions, that we have these free birds out there going around the world, and it's pretty cool to think about when we've got our own restrictions.
Nice way to close this episode. Thanks, Conrad, for your insight, and I will speak to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thank you, Justin.